or inside view would have no such compunctions. Sources inside the investigation say they found a pair of the scribe's panties in the accused rapist's drawer. Blue Victoria's Secret hip huggers trimmed with lace.
"I can't tell," she said. "I won't tell."
"But there were others before you. There could be others after you."
She pushed this thought away. She was too tired to consider what might or might not be her moral responsibility. She'd work on that part later, if God meant to grant her a later. And it seemed he might. But not on this deserted road where any set of approaching lights might have her rapist behind it. Hers. He was hers now. 13. A mile or so after passing the college sign, Tess began to hear a low, rhythmic thudding that seemed to come up from the road through her feet. Her first thought was of H.G. Wells's mutant Morlocks tending their machinery deep in the bowels of the earth. But another 5 minutes clarified the sound. It was coming through the air, not from the ground, and it was one she knew, the heartbeat of a bass guitar. The rest of the band coalesced around it as she walked. She began to see light on the horizon. Not headlights, but the white of arc sodiums and the red gleam of neon. The band was playing Mustang Sally, and she could hear laughter. It was drunken and beautiful, punctuated by happy party-down whoops. The sound made her feel like crying some more. The roadhouse, a big old honky-tonk barn with a huge dirt parking lot that looked full to capacity, was called the Stagger Inn. She stood at the edge of the glare cast by the parking lot lights, frowning. Why so many cars? Then she remembered it was Friday night. Apparently the Stagger Inn was the place to go on Friday nights if you were from college or any of the surrounding towns. They would have a phone, but there were too many people. They would see her bruised face and leaning nose. They would want to know what had happened to her, and she was in no shape to make up a story. At least not yet. Even a payphone outside was no good, because she could see people out there, too. Lots of them. Of course, these days you had to go outside if you wanted to smoke a cigarette. Also, he could be there. Hadn't he been capering around her at one point, singing a Rolling Stones song in his awful, tuneless voice? Tess supposed she might have dreamed that part, or hallucinated it. But she didn't think so. Wasn't it possible that after hiding her car, he'd come right here to the Stagger Inn, pipes all cleaned and ready to party the night away? The band launched into a perfectly adequate cover of an old Cramp song, "Can Your Pussy Do the Dog?" No, Tess thought, but today a dog certainly did my pussy. The old Tess would not have approved of such a joke. But the new Tess thought it was pretty goddamn funny. She barked a hoarse laugh and got walking again, moving to the other side of the road where the lights from the roadhouse parking lot did not quite reach. As she passed the far side of the building, she saw an old white van backed up to the loading dock. There were no arc sodiums on this side of the Stagger Inn, but the moonlight was enough to show her the skeleton pounding its cupcake drums. No wonder the van hadn't stopped to pick up the nail-studded road litter. The zombie bakers had been late for the load-in, and that wasn't good, because on Friday nights, the Stagger Inn was hopping with the bopping, rolling with the strolling, and reeling with the feeling.
"Can your pussy do the dog?"
Tess asked, and pulled the filthy carpet remnant a little tighter around her neck. It was no mink stole, but on a cool October night, it was better than nothing. 14. When Tess got to the intersection of Stag Road and Route 47, she saw something beautiful. A gas and dash, with two pay telephones on the cinder block wall between the restrooms. She used the women's first, and had to put a hand over her mouth to stifle a cry when her urine started to flow. It was as if someone had lit a book of matches in there. When she got up from the toilet, fresh tears were rolling down her cheeks. The water in the bowl was a pastel pink. She blotted herself, very gently, with a pad of toilet paper, then flushed. She would have taken another wad to fold into the crotch of her underwear, but of course she couldn't do that. The giant had taken her underpants as a souvenir.
"You bastard," she said.
She paused with her hand on the doorknob, looking at the bruised, wide-eyed woman in the water-spotted metal mirror over the wash basin. Then she went out. 15. She discovered that using a payphone in this modern age had grown strangely difficult, even if you had your calling card number memorized. The first phone she tried worked only one way. She could hear the directory assistance operator, but the directory assistance operator couldn't hear her, and broke such connection as there was. The other phone was tilted askew on the cinder block wall. Not encouraging. But it worked. There was a steady, annoying underwhine, but at least she and the operator could communicate. Only Tess had no pen or pencil. There were several writing implements in her purse, but of course her purse was gone.
"Can't you just connect me?" she asked the operator.
"No, ma'am. You have to dial it yourself in order to utilize your credit card." The operator spoke in a voice of someone explaining the obvious to a stupid child. This didn't make Tess angry. She felt like a stupid child. Then she saw how dirty the cinder block wall was. She told the operator to give her the number, and when it came, she wrote it in dust with her finger. Before she could start dialing, a truck pulled into the parking lot. Her heart launched itself into her throat with dizzying, acrobatic ease. And when two laughing boys in high school jackets got out and whipped into the store, she was glad it was up there. It blocked the scream that surely would have come out otherwise. She felt the world trying to go away and leaned her head against the wall for a moment, gasping for breath. She closed her eyes. She saw the giant towering over her, hands in the pockets of his bibs, and opened her eyes again. She dialed the number written in dust on the wall. She braced herself for an answering machine, or for a bored dispatcher telling her that they had no cars. Of course they didn't. It was Friday night. Were you born stupid, lady, or did you just grow that way? But the phone was answered on the second ring by a businesslike woman who identified herself as Andrea. She listened to Tess and said they would send a car right out. Her driver would be Manuel. Yes, she knew exactly where Tess was calling from, because they ran cars out to the Stagger Inn all the time.
"Okay, but I'm not there," Tess said. "I'm at the intersection about half a mile down from the..."
"Yes, ma'am, I have that," Andrea said. "The Gas and Dash. Sometimes we go there, too. People often walk down and call if they've had a little too much to drink. It'll probably be 45 minutes, maybe even an hour."
"That's fine," Tess said.
The tears were falling again, tears of gratitude this time, although she told herself not to relax, because in stories like this, the heroine's hopes so often turned out to be false.
"That's absolutely fine. I'll be around the corner by the pay telephones. And I'll be watching.
Now she'll ask me if I had a little too much to drink, because I probably sound that way." But Andrea only wanted to know if she would be paying with cash or credit.
"American Express. I should be in your computer."
"Yes, ma'am, you are. Thank you for calling Royal Limousine, where every customer is treated like royalty." Andrea clicked off before Tess could say she was very welcome. She started to hang up the phone, and then a man, him, ran around the corner of the store right at her. This time there was no chance of screaming. She was paralyzed with terror. It was one of the teenage boys. He went past without looking at her and hooked a left into the men's. The door slammed. A moment later she heard the enthusiastic, horse-like sound of a young man voiding an awesomely healthy bladder. Tess went down the side of the building and around the back. There she stood beside a reeking dumpster. "No," she thought, "I'm not standing. I'm lurking." Waiting for the young man to finish and be gone. When he was, she walked back to the payphones to watch the road. In spite of all the places where she hurt, her belly was rumbling with hunger. She had missed her dinner, had been too busy being raped and almost killed to eat. She would have been glad to have any of the snacks they sold in places like this. Even some of those little nasty peanut butter crackers, so weirdly yellow, would have been a treat. But she had no money. Even if she had, she wouldn't have gone in there. She knew what kind of lights they had in roadside convenience stores like Gas and Dash, those bright and heartless fluorescents that made even healthy people look like they were suffering from pancreatic cancer. The clerk behind the counter would have looked at her bruised cheeks and forehead, her broken nose and her swollen lips, and he or she might not say anything, but Tess would see the widening of the eyes and maybe a quickly suppressed twitch of the lips. Because face it, people could think a beat-up woman was funny, especially on a Friday night. Who tuned up on you, lady, and what did you do to deserve it? Wouldn't you come across after some guy spent his overtime on you? That reminded her of an old joke she'd heard somewhere. Why are there 300,000 battered women each year in America? Because they won't fucking listen.
Never mind, she whispered. I'll have something to eat when I get home. Tuna salad, maybe.
It sounded good, but part of her was convinced that her days of eating tuna salad, or nasty yellow convenience store peanut butter crackers for that matter, were all over. The idea of a limo pulling up and driving her out of this nightmare was an insane mirage. From somewhere to her left, Tess could hear cars rushing by on I-84. The road she would have taken if she hadn't been so pleased to be offered a shorter way home. Over there on the turnpike, people who had never been raped or stuffed in pipes were going places. Tess thought the sound of their blithe travel was the loneliest she'd ever heard. 16. The limo came. It was a Lincoln town car. The man behind the wheel got out and looked around. Tess observed him closely from the corner of the store. He was wearing a dark suit. He was a small, bespectacled fellow who didn't look like a rapist. But of course, not all giants were rapists, and not all rapists were giants. She had to trust him, though. If she were to get home and feed Fritzy, there was no other option. So she dropped her filthy makeshift stole beside the payphone that actually worked and walked slowly and steadily toward the car. The light shining through the store windows seemed blindingly bright after the shadows at the side of the building, and she knew what her face looked like. He'll ask what happened to me, and then he'll ask if I want to go to the hospital. But Manuel, who might have seen worse, it wasn't impossible, only held the door for her and said, "Welcome to Royal Limousine, ma'am." He had a soft Hispanic accent to go with his olive skin and dark eyes.
"Where I'm treated like royalty," Tess said.
She tried to smile. It hurt her swollen lips.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Nothing else." God bless Manuel, who might have seen worse, perhaps back where he'd come from, perhaps in the back of this very car. Who knew what secrets limo drivers kept? It was a question that might have a good book hidden in it. Not the kind she wrote, of course. Only who knew what kind of books she might write after this, or if she would write any more at all. Tonight's adventure might have turned that solitary joy out of her for a while, maybe even forever. It was impossible to tell. She got into the back of the car, moving like an old woman with advanced osteoporosis. When she was seated and had closed the door, she wrapped her fingers around the handle and watched closely, wanting to make sure it was Manuel who got in behind the wheel, and not the giant in the bib overalls. In Stag Road Horror 2, it would have been the giant. One more turn of the screw before the credits. Have some irony. It's good for your blood. But it was Manuel who got in. Of course it was. She relaxed. "The address I have is 19 Primrose Lane in Stoke Village. Is that correct?" For a moment, she couldn't remember. She had punched her calling card number into the payphone without a pause, but she was blanking on her own address. "Relax," she told herself. "It's over. This isn't a horror movie. It's your life. You've had a terrible experience, but it's over. So relax."
"Yes, Manuel, that's right." Will you want to be making any stops, or are we going right to your home? It was the closest he came to mentioning what the lights of the gas and dash must have shown him when she walked to the town car. It was only luck that she was still taking her oral contraceptive pills. Luck and perhaps optimism. She hadn't had so much as a one-night stand for 3 years, unless you counted tonight. But luck had been in short supply today, and she was grateful for this short stroke of it. She was sure Manuel could find an all-night pharmacy somewhere along the way. Limo drivers seemed to know all that stuff. But she didn't think she would have been able to walk into a drugstore and ask for the morning after pill. Her face would have made it all too obvious why she needed one. And of course, there was the money problem.
No other stops. Just take me home, please.
Soon they were on I-84, which was busy with Friday night traffic. Stag Road and the deserted store were behind her. What was ahead of her was her own house, with a security system and a lock for every door. And that was good. 17. It all went exactly as she had visualized. The arrival, the tip added to the credit card slip, the walk up the flower-lined path. She asked Manuel to stay, illuminating her with his headlights, until she was inside. The sound of Fritzy meowing as she tilted the mailbox and fished the emergency key off its hook. Then she was inside, and Fritzy was twining anxiously around her feet, wanting to be picked up and stroked, wanting to be fed. Tess did those things, but first she locked the front door behind her, then set the burglar alarm for the first time in months. When she saw Armed flash in the little green window above the keypad, she at last began to feel something like her true self. She looked at the kitchen clock and was astounded to see it was only 11:15. While Fritzy was eating his fancy feast, she checked the doors to the backyard and the side patio, making sure they were both locked, then the windows. The alarm's command box was supposed to tell you if something was open, but she didn't trust it. When she was positive everything was secure, she went to the front hall closet and took down a box that had been on the top shelf so long there was a scrim of dust on the top. 5 years ago, there had been a rash of burglaries and home invasions in northern Connecticut and southern Massachusetts. The bad boys were mostly drug addicts hooked on 80s, which was what its many New England fans called OxyContin. Residents were warned to be particularly careful and take reasonable precautions. Tess had no strong feelings about handguns, pro or con, nor had she felt especially worried about strange men breaking in at night. Not then. But a gun seemed to come under the heading of reasonable precautions. And she had been meaning to educate herself about pistols for the next Willow Grove book anyway. The burglary scare had seemed like the perfect opportunity. She went to the Hartford gun store that rated best on the internet, and the clerk had recommended a Smith & Wesson 38 model he called a lemon squeezer. She bought it mostly because she liked that name. He also told her about a good shooting range on the outskirts of Stoke Village. Tess had dutifully taken her gun there once the 48-hour waiting period was up, and she was actually able to obtain it. She had fired off 400 rounds or so over the course of a week, enjoying the thrill of banging away at first, but quickly becoming bored. The gun had been in the closet ever since, stored in its box, along with 50 rounds of ammunition and her carry permit. She loaded it, feeling better, safer, with each filled chamber. She put it on the kitchen counter, then checked the answering machine. There was one message. It was from Patsy McLean next door. "I didn't see any lights this evening, so I guess you decided to stay over in Chicopee. Or maybe you went to Boston? Anyway, I used the key behind the mailbox and fed Fritzy. Oh, and I put your mail on the hall table. All adverts. Sorry. Call me tomorrow before I go to work if you're back. Just want to know you got in safe."
"Hey, Fritz," Tess said, bending over to stroke him. "I guess you got double rations tonight. Pretty clever of you."
Wings of grayness came over her vision, and if she hadn't caught hold of the kitchen table, she would have gone sprawling full length on the linoleum.
She uttered a cry of surprise that sounded faint and far away. Fritzy twitched his ears back, gave her a narrow, assessing look, seemed to decide she wasn't going to fall over, at least not on him, and went back to his second supper. Tess straightened up slowly, holding onto the table for safety's sake, and opened the fridge. There was no tuna salad, but there was cottage cheese with strawberry jam. She ate it eagerly, scraping the plastic container with her spoon to get every last curd. It was cool and smooth on her hurt throat. She wasn't sure she could have eaten flesh anyway, not even tuna out of a can. She drank apple juice straight from the bottle, belched, then trudged to the downstairs bathroom. She took the gun along, curling her fingers outside the trigger guard, as she had been taught. There was an oval magnifying mirror standing on the shelf above the wash basin, a Christmas gift from her brother in New Mexico. Written in gold gilt script above it were the words, "Pretty me." The old Tess had used it for tweezing her eyebrows and doing quick fixes to her makeup. The new one used it to examine her eyes. They were bloodshot, of course, but the pupils looked the same size. She turned off the bathroom light, counted to 20, then turned it back on and watched her pupils contract. That looked okay, too. So, probably no skull fracture. Maybe a concussion. A light concussion, but... as if I'd know. I've got a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Connecticut and an advanced degree in old lady detectives who spend at least a quarter of each book exchanging recipes I crib from the internet and then change just enough so I won't get sued for plagiarism. I could go into a coma or die of a brain hemorrhage in the night. Patsy would find me the next time she came in to feed the cat. You need to see a doctor, Tessa Jean, and you know it. What she knew was that if she went to her doctor, her misfortune really could become public property. Doctors guaranteed confidentiality, it was part of their oath, and a woman who made her living as a lawyer or a cleaning woman or a realtor could probably count on getting it. Tess might get it herself. It was certainly possible, probable even. On the other hand, look what had happened to Farrah Fawcett. Tabloid fodder when some hospital employee blabbed. Tess herself had heard rumors about the psychiatric misadventures of a male novelist who had been a chart staple for years with his tales of lusty derring-do. Her own agent had passed the juiciest of these rumors on to Tess over lunch not 2 months ago, and Tess had listened. I did more than listen, she thought as she looked at her magnified, beaten self. I passed that puppy on just as soon as I could. Even if the doctor and his staff kept mum about the lady mystery writer who had been beaten, raped, and robbed on her way home from a public appearance, what about the other patients who might see her in the waiting room? To some of them, she wouldn't be just another woman with a bruised face that practically screamed beating. She would be Stoke Village's resident novelist, you know the one. They made a TV movie about her old lady detectives a year or two ago. It was on Lifetime Channel. And my God, you should have seen her. Her nose wasn't broken after all. It was hard to believe anything could hurt that badly and not be broken. But it wasn't. Swollen, of course, poor thing. And it hurt, but she could breathe through it and she had some Vicodin upstairs that would manage the pain tonight. But she had a couple of blooming shiners, a bruised and swollen cheek, and a ring of bruises around her throat. That was the worst, the sort of necklace people got in only one way. There were also assorted bumps, bruises, and scratches on her back, legs, and tushy, but clothes and hose would hide the worst of those. Great, I'm a poet, and I don't know it. The throat. I could wear a turtleneck. Absolutely. October was turtleneck weather. As for Patsy, she could say she'd fallen downstairs and hit her face in the night. Say that I thought I heard a noise, and Fritzy got between my feet when I went downstairs to check. Fritzy heard his name and meowed from the bathroom door. Say I hit my stupid face on the newel post at the bottom. I could even put a little mark on the post, of course she could. Possibly with the meat tenderizing hammer she had in one of her kitchen drawers. Nothing gaudy, just a tap or two to chip the paint. Such a story wouldn't fool a doctor or a sharp old lady detective like Doreen Marquis, doyen of the Knitting Society. But it would fool sweet Patsy McSee, whose husband had surely never raised a hand to her a single time in the 20 years they'd been together.
"It's not that I have anything to be ashamed about," she whispered at the woman in the mirror, the new woman with the crooked nose and the puffy lips. "It's not that."
True, but public exposure would make her ashamed. She would be naked, a naked victim.
"But what about the women, Tessa Jean? The women in the pipe?"
She would have to think about them. But not tonight. Tonight she was tired, in pain, and harrowed to the bottom of her soul. Deep inside her.
In her harrowed soul.
She felt a glowing ember of fury at the man responsible for this. The man who had put her in this position. She looked at the pistol lying beside the basin, and knew that if he were here, she would use it on him without a moment's hesitation. Knowing that made her feel confused about herself. It also made her feel a little stronger. 18. She chipped at the newel post with the meat tenderizing hammer, by then so tired she felt like a dream in some other woman's head. She examined the mark, decided it looked too deliberate, and gave several more light taps around the edges of the blow. When she thought it looked like something she might have done with the side of her face, where the worst bruise was, she went slowly up the stairs and down the hall, holding her gun in one hand. For a moment she hesitated outside her bedroom door, which was standing ajar. What if he was in there? If he had her purse, he had her address. The burglar alarm had not been set until she got back.
So sloppy.
He could have parked his old F-150 around the corner. He could have forced the kitchen door lock. It probably wouldn't have taken much more than a chisel.
If he was here, I'd smell him, that man's sweat, and I'd shoot him. No lie down on the floor. No keep your hands up while I dial 911. No horror movie bullshit. I'd just shoot him. But you know what I'd say first?
You like it. It likes you, she said in her low rasp of a voice.
Yes, that was it exactly. He wouldn't understand, but she would. She discovered she sort of wanted him in her room. That probably meant the new woman was more than a little crazy, but so what? If it all came out then, it would be worth it. Shooting him would make public humiliation bearable. And look at the bright side. It would probably help sales.
I'd like to see the terror in his eyes when he realized I really meant to do it. That might make at least some of this right.
It seemed to take her groping hand an age to find the bedroom light switch, and of course she kept expecting her fingers to be grabbed while she fumbled. She took off her clothes slowly, uttering one watery, miserable sob when she unzipped her pants and saw dried blood in her pubic hair. She ran the shower as hot as she could stand it, washing the places that could bear to be washed, letting the water rinse the rest. The clean, hot water. She wanted his smell off her, and the mildewy smell of the carpet remnant, too. Afterwards, she sat on the toilet, this time peeing hurt less, but the bolt of pain that went through her head when she tried, very tentatively, to straighten her leaning nose made her cry out. Well, so what? Nell Gwynn, the famous Elizabethan actress, had a bent nose. Tess was sure she had read that somewhere. She put on flannel pajamas and shuffled to bed, where she lay with all the lights on and the lemon squeezer 38 on the night table, thinking she would never sleep, that her inflamed imagination would turn every sound from the street into the approach of the giant. But then Fritzy jumped on the bed, curled himself beside her, and began to purr. That was better.
I'm home, she thought. I'm home, I'm home, I'm home.
19. When she woke up, the inarguably sane light of 6 a.m. was streaming through the windows. There were things that needed to be done and decisions that needed to be made. But for the moment, it was enough to be alive and in her own bed instead of stuffed into a culvert. This time, peeing felt almost normal, and there was no blood. She got into the shower again, once more running the water as hot as she could stand it, closing her eyes and letting it beat on her throbbing face. When she had had all that she could take, she worked shampoo into her hair, doing it slowly and methodically, using her fingers to massage her scalp, skipping the painful spot where he must have hit her. At first, the deep scratch on her back stung, but that passed and she felt a kind of bliss. She hardly thought of the shower scene in Psycho at all. The shower was always where she had done her best thinking, a womb-like environment, and if she had ever needed to think both hard and well, it was now.
I don't want to see Dr. Hedstrom, and I don't need to see Dr. Hedstrom. That decision's been made. Although later, a couple of weeks from now maybe, when my face looks more or less normal again, I'll have to get checked out for STDs.
Don't forget the AIDS test, she said, and the thought made her grimace hard enough to hurt her mouth. It was a scary thought. Nevertheless, the test would have to be taken, for her own peace of mind. And none of that addressed what she now recognized as this morning's central issue. What she did or didn't do about her own violation was her own business, but that was not true of the women in the pipe. They had lost far more than she. And what about the next woman the giant attacked? That there would be another, she had no doubt. Maybe not for a month or a year, but there would be. As she turned off the shower, Tess realized, again, that it might even be her, if he went back to check the culvert and found her gone. And her clothes gone from the store, of course. If he looked through her purse, and surely he had, then he did have her address.
Also my diamond earrings, she said. Fucking pervert son of a bitch stole my earrings.
Even if he steered clear of the store and the culvert for a while, those women belonged to her now. They were her responsibility, and she couldn't shirk it just because her picture might appear on the cover of Inside View. In the calm morning light of a suburban Connecticut morning, the answer was ridiculously simple. An anonymous call to the police. The fact that a professional novelist with 10 years' experience hadn't thought of it right away almost deserved a yellow penalty card. She would give them the location, the deserted You Like It, It Likes You store on Stagg Road, and she would describe the giant. How hard could it be to locate a man like that, or a blue Ford F-150 pickup with Bondo around the headlights? Easy as can be-sy. But while she was drying her hair, her eyes fell on her lemon squeezer 38, and she thought, too easy as can be-sy, because...
What's in it for me? She asked Fritzy, who was sitting in the doorway and looking at her with his luminous green eyes.
Just what's in that for me?
20. Standing in the kitchen an hour and a half later, her cereal bowl soaking in the sink, her second cup of coffee growing cold on the counter, talking on the phone.
Oh, my God, Patsy exclaimed. I'm coming right over.
No, I'm fine, Pats, and you'll be late for work.
Saturday mornings are strictly optional, and you should go to the doctor. What if you're concussed or something?
I'm not concussed, just colorful. And I'd be ashamed to go to the doctor because I was 3 drinks over the limit. At least 3. The only sensible thing I did all night was call a limo to bring me home.
You're sure your nose isn't broken?
Positive.
Well, almost positive.
Is Fritzy all right?
Tess burst into perfectly genuine laughter.
I go downstairs half-shot in the middle of the night because the smoke detector's beeping, trip over the cat and almost kill myself. And your sympathies are with the cat. Nice.
Honey, no.
I'm just teasing, Tess said. Go on to work and stop worrying. I just didn't want you to scream when you saw me. I've got a couple of absolutely beautiful shiners. If I had an ex-husband, you'd probably think he paid me a visit.
Nobody would dare to put a hand on you,
Patsy said. You're feisty, girl.
That's right, Tess said. I take no shit.
You sound hoarse.
On top of everything else, I'm getting a cold.
Well, if you need something tonight, chicken soup, a couple of old Percocets, a Johnny Depp DVD.
I'll call if I do. Now go on. Fashion-conscious women seeking the elusive size 6 Ann Taylor are depending on you.
Piss off, woman, Patsy said, and hung up laughing. Tess took her coffee to the kitchen table. The gun was sitting on it next to the sugar bowl. Not quite a Dolly image, but damn close. The image doubled as she burst into tears. It was the memory of her own cheery voice that did it. The sound of the lie she would now live until it felt like truth.
You bastard, she shouted. You fuck bastard. I hate you.
She had showered twice in less than 7 hours and still felt dirty. She had douched, but she thought she could still feel him in there, his cock slime. She bolted to her feet. From the corner of her eye glimpsed her alarmed cat racing down the front hall, and arrived at the sink just in time to avoid making a mess on the floor. Her coffee and Cheerios came up in a single hard contraction. When she was sure she was done, she collected her pistol and went upstairs to take another shower. 21. When she was done and wrapped in a comforting terry cloth robe, she lay down on her bed to think about where she should go to make her anonymous call. Someplace big and busy would be best. Someplace with a parking lot, so she could hang up and then scat. Stoke Village Mall sounded right. There was also the question of which authorities to call. College, or would that be too deputy dog? Maybe the state police would be better, and she should write down what she meant to say. The call would go quicker. She'd be less likely to forget Tess drifted off, lying on her bed in a bar of sunlight. 22. The telephone was ringing far away in some adjacent universe. Then it stopped, and Tess heard her own voice, the pleasantly impersonal recording that started, "You have reached?" This was followed by someone leaving a message. A woman. By the time Tess struggled back to wakefulness, the caller had clicked off. She looked at the clock on the night table and saw it was 9:45. She'd slept another 2 hours. For a moment she was alarmed. Maybe she'd suffered a concussion or a fracture after all. Then she relaxed. She'd had a lot of exercise the previous night. Much of it had been extremely unpleasant. But exercise was exercise. Falling asleep again was natural. She might even take another nap this afternoon. Another shower, for sure. But she had an errand to run first, a responsibility to fulfill. She put on a long tweed skirt and a turtleneck that was actually too big for her. It lapped the underside of her chin. That was fine with Tess. She had applied concealer to the bruise on her cheek. It didn't cover it completely, nor would even her biggest pair of sunglasses completely obscure her black eyes. The swollen lips were a lost cause. But the makeup helped just the same. The very act of applying it made her feel more anchored in her life, more in charge. Downstairs, she pushed the play button on her answering machine, thinking the call had probably been from Ramona Norville, doing the obligatory day-after follow-up. We had fun. Hope you had fun. The feedback was great. Please come again. Not bloody likely. Blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't Ramona. The message was from a woman who identified herself as Betsy Neal. She said she was calling from the Stagger Inn. As part of our effort to discourage drinking and driving, our policy is to courtesy call people who leave their cars in our lot after closing, Betsy Neal said. Your Ford Expedition Connecticut license plate 775 NSD will be available for pickup until 5 p.m. this evening. After 5, it will be towed to Excellent Auto Repair, 1500 John Higgins Road, North College, at your expense. Please note that we don't have your keys, ma'am. You must have taken them with you. Betsy Neal paused. We have other property of yours. So please come to the office. Remember that I'll need some ID. Thank you and have a nice day. Tess sat down on her sofa and laughed. Before listening to the Neil woman's canned speech, she had been planning to drive her expedition to the mall. She didn't have her purse. She didn't have her key ring. She didn't have her damn car. But she had still planned to just walk out to the driveway, climb in, and... She sat back against the cushion, whooping and pounding a fist on her thigh. Fritzy was under the easy chair on the other side of the room, looking at her as if she were mad. "We're all mad here, so have another cup of tea," she thought, and laughed harder than ever. When she finally stopped, only it felt more like running down, she played the message again. This time what she focused on was the Neil woman saying they had other property of hers. Her purse? Perhaps even her diamond earrings? But that would be too good to be true, wouldn't it? Arriving at the Stagger Inn in a black car from Royal Limo might be a little too memorable, so she called Stoke Village Taxi. The dispatcher said they'd be glad to run her out to what he called the Stagger for a flat $50 fee.
"Sorry to charge you so much," he said, "but the driver's got to come back empty."
"How do you know that?"
Tess asked, bemused.
"Left your car, right? Happens all the time, especially on weekends, although we also get calls after karaoke nights. Your cab will be there in 15 minutes or less."
Tess ate a Pop-Tart, swallowing hurt, but she had lost her first try at breakfast and was hungry, then stood at the living room window, watching for the taxi and bouncing her spare expedition key on her palm. She decided on a change of plan. Never mind Stoke Village Mall, once she'd collected her car and whatever other property Betsy Neal was holding, she would drive the half mile or so to the Gas and Dash and call the police from there. It seemed only fitting. 23. When her cab turned onto Stag Road, Tessa's pulse began to rise. By the time they reached the Stagger Inn, it was flying along at what felt like 130 beats a minute. The cabbie must have seen something in his rearview mirror, or maybe it was just the visible signs of the beating that prompted his question.
"Everything okay, ma'am?"
"Peachy," she said. "It's just that I didn't plan on coming back here this morning."
"Few do," the cabbie said. He was sucking on a toothpick, which made a slow and philosophical journey from one side of his mouth to the other. "They got your keys, I suppose. Left them with the bartender."
"Oh, no trouble there," she said brightly. "But they're holding other property for me. The lady who called wouldn't say what, and I can't for the life of me think what it could be."
"Good God, I sound like one of my old lady detectives."
The cabbie rolled his toothpick back to its starting point. It was his only reply.
"I'll pay you an extra $10 to wait until I come out," Tess said, nodding at the roadhouse. "I want to make sure my car starts."
"No problemo," the cabbie said.
"And if I scream because he's in there, waiting for me, come on the run, okay?"
But she wouldn't have said that even if she could have done so without sounding absolutely bonkers. The cab driver was fat, 50, and wheezy. He'd be no match for the giant if this was a setup, which in a horror movie, it would be.
"Lured back," Tess thought dismally. "Lured back by a phone call from the giant's girlfriend, who's just as crazy as he is."
Foolish, paranoid idea. But the walk to the Stagger Inn's door seemed long, and the hard-packed dirt made her walking shoes seem very loud.
Clump, clud, clump.
The parking lot that had been a sea of cars last night was now deserted, save for four automotive islands, one of which was her expedition. It was at the very back of the lot. Sure, he would not have wanted to be observed putting it there. And she could see the left front tire. It was a plain old black wall that didn't match the other three, but otherwise it looked fine. He had changed her tire. Of course he had. How else could he have moved it away from
his recreational facility. His kill zone. He drove it down here, parked,
walked back to the deserted store, and then off he went in his old F-150. Good thing I didn't come too sooner. He'd have found me wandering around in a daze, and I wouldn't be here now.
She looked back over her shoulder. In one of the movies she now could not stop thinking about, she surely would have seen the cab speeding away,
leaving me to my fate.
But it was still right there. She lifted a hand to the driver, and he lifted his in return. She was fine. Her car was here, and the giant wasn't. The giant was at his house, his lair, quite possibly still sleeping off the previous evening's exertions. The sign on the door said, "We are closed." Tess knocked and got no response. She tried the knob, and when it turned, sinister movie plots returned to her mind. The really stupid plots, where the knob always turns and the heroine calls out, in a tremulous voice, "Is anybody there?" Everyone knows she's crazy to go in, but she does anyway. Tess looked back at the cab again, saw it was still right there, reminded herself that she was carrying a loaded gun in her spare purse, and went in anyway. 24. She entered a foyer that ran the length of the building on the parking lot side. The walls were decorated with publicity stills, bands in leather, bands in jeans, an all-girl band in miniskirts. An auxiliary bar stretched out beyond the coat racks. No stools, just a rail where you could have a drink while you waited for someone, or because the bar inside was too packed. A single red sign glowed above the ranked bottles. Budweiser.
"You like Bud. Bud likes you," Tess thought.
She took off her dark glasses so she could walk without stumbling into something, and crossed the foyer to peep into the main room. It was vast and redolent of beer. There was a disco ball, now dark and still. The wooden floor reminded her of the roller skating rink where she and her girlfriends had all but lived during the summer between eighth grade and high school. The instruments were still up on the bandstand, suggesting that the zombie bakers would be back tonight for another heaping bowl of rock and roll.
"Hello?" her voice echoed. "I'm right here," a voice replied softly from behind her.
25. If it had been a man's voice, Tess would have shrieked. She managed to avoid that, but she still whirled around so quickly that she stumbled a little. The woman standing in the coat alcove, a skinny breath of a thing, no more than 5'3", blinked in surprise and took a step back.
"Whoa, easy."
"You startled me," Tess said.
"I see I did."
The woman's tiny, perfect oval of a face was surrounded by a cloud of teased black hair. A pencil peeked from it. She had piquant blue eyes that didn't quite match.
"A Picasso girl," Tess thought. "I was in the office. Are you the expedition lady or the Honda lady?"
"Expedition."
"Have ID?"
"Yes, two pieces, but only one with my picture on it, my passport. The other stuff was in my purse, my other purse. I thought that was what you might have."
"No, sorry. Maybe you stashed it under the seat or something. We only look in glove compartments, and of course we can't even do that if the car is locked. Yours wasn't, and your phone number was on the insurance card. But probably you know that. Maybe you'll find your purse at home."
Neil's voice suggested that this wasn't likely.
"One photo ID will be okay if it looks like you, I guess."
Neil led Tess to a door at the back of the coat area, then down a narrow, curving corridor that skirted the main room. There were more band photos on the walls. At one point, they passed through a fume of chlorine that stung Tess's eyes and tender throat.
"If you think the John smell now, you should be here when the joint is going full tilt,"
Neil said, then added,
"Oh, I forgot. You were."
Tess made no comment. At the end of the hallway was a door marked "Office Staff Only." The room beyond was large, pleasant, and filled with morning sunshine. A framed picture of Barack Obama hung on the wall, above a bumper sticker bearing the "Yes, We Can" slogan. Tess couldn't see her cab, the building was in the way, but she could see its shadow.
"That's good. Stay right there and get your $10,
And if I don't come out, don't come in. Just call the police.
Neil went to the desk in the corner and sat down.
Let's see your ID.
Tess opened her purse, fumbled past the 38, and brought out her passport and the Authors Guild card. Neil gave the passport photo only a cursory glance, but when she saw the guild card, her eyes widened.
You're the Willow Grove lady.
Tess smiled gamely.
It hurt her lips.
Guilty as charged.
Her voice sounded foggy, as though she were getting over a bad cold.
My gran loves those books.
Many grands do,
Tess said.
When the affection finally filters down to the next generation, the one not currently living on fixed incomes, I'm gonna buy myself a chateau in France.
Sometimes this earned her a smile. Not from Ms. Neal, however.
I hope that didn't happen here.
She wasn't more specific, and didn't have to be. Tess knew what she was talking about, and Betsy Neal knew she knew. Tess thought of revisiting the story she'd already told Patsy. The beeping smoke detector alarm, the cat under her feet, the collision with the Newell post, and didn't bother. This woman had a look of daytime efficiency about her and probably visited the Stagger Inn as infrequently as possible during its hours of operation, but she was clearly under no illusions about what sometimes happened here when the hour grew late and the guests grew drunk. She was, after all, the one who came in early on Saturday mornings to make the courtesy calls. She had probably heard her share of morning-after stories featuring midnight stumbles, slips in the shower, etc., etc.
Not here,
Tess said.
Don't worry. Not even in the parking lot? If you ran into trouble there, I'll have to have Mr. Rumble talk with the security staff. Mr. Rumble's the boss, and security's supposed to check the video monitors regularly on busy nights.
It happened after I left.
I really do have to make the report anonymously now, if I mean to report it at all, because I'm lying and she'll remember. If she meant to report it at all? Of course she did. Right?
I'm very sorry, Neil paused, seeming to debate with herself. Then she said, I don't mean to offend you, but you probably don't have any business in a place like this to begin with. It didn't turn out so well for you, and if it got into the papers, well, my gran would be very disappointed.
Tess agreed, and because she could embellish convincingly, it was the talent that paid the bills after all, she did.
A bad boyfriend is sharper than a serpent's tooth. I think the Bible says that. Or maybe it's Dr. Phil. In any case, I've broken up with him.
A lot of women say that, then weaken. And a guy who does it once...
will do it again. Yes, I know, I was very foolish. If you don't have my purse, what property of mine do you have?
Ms. Neal turned in her swivel chair. The sun licked across her face, momentarily highlighting those unusual blue eyes, opened one of her file cabinets, and brought out Tom the Tom-Tom. Tess was delighted to see her old traveling buddy. It didn't make things all better, but it was a step in the right direction.
We're not supposed to remove anything from patrons' cars, just get the address and the phone number if we can, then lock it up. But I didn't like to leave this. Thieves don't mind breaking a window to get a particularly tasty item. And it was sitting right there on your dashboard.
Thank you.
Tess felt tears springing into her eyes behind her dark glasses and willed them back.
That was very thoughtful.
Betsy Neal smiled, which transformed her stern Ms. taking care of business face to radiant in an instant.
Very welcome. And when that boyfriend of yours comes crawling back, asking for a second chance, think of my gran and all your other loyal readers. And tell him no way, Jose.
She considered.
But do it with a chain on your door, because a bad boyfriend really is sharper than a serpent's tooth.
That's good advice. Listen, I have to go. I told the cab to wait while I made sure I was really going to get my car.
And that might have been all. It really might have been. But then Neil asked, with becoming diffidence, if Tess would mind signing an autograph for her grandmother. Tess told her, of course not. And in spite of all that had happened, watched with real amusement as Neil found a piece of business stationery and used a ruler to tear off the Stagger Inn logo at the top before handing it across the desk.
Make it to Mary, a true fan, Can you do that?
Tess could, and as she was adding the date, a fresh confabulation came to mind.
A man helped me when my boyfriend and I were, you know, tussling. If not for him, I might have been hurt a lot worse.
Yes, raped, even.
I'd like to thank him, but I don't know his name.
I doubt if I could do you much good there. I'm just the office help.
But you're local, right?
Yes.
I met him at the little store down the road.
The Gas and Dash?
I think that's the name. It's where my boyfriend and I had our argument. It was about the car. I didn't want to drive and I wouldn't let him. We were arguing about it all the time we walked down the road. Staggered down the road. Staggered down Stag Road.
Neil smiled, as people do when they've heard a joke many times before.
Anyway, this guy came along in an old blue pickup truck with that plastic stuff for rust around the headlights. Bondo? I think that's what it's called.
Knowing damn well that was what it was called. Her father had supported the company almost single-handed.
Anyway, I remember thinking when he got out that he wasn't really riding in that truck. He was wearing it.
When she handed the signed sheet of paper back across the desk, she saw that Betsy Neal was now actually grinning.
Oh my God, I might actually know who he was.
Really?
Was he big, or was he real big?
Real big, Tess said. She felt a peculiar watchful happiness that seemed located not in her head but in the center of her chest. It was the way she felt when the strings of some outlandish plot actually started to come together, pulling tight like the top of a nicely crafted tote bag. She always felt both surprised and not surprised when this happened. There was no satisfaction like it.
Did you happen to notice if he was wearing a ring on his little finger? Red stone?
Yes, like a ruby, only too big to be real. And a brown hat. Neil was nodding, with white splatters on it. He's been wearing the damn thing for 10 years. That's Big Driver you're talking about.
I don't know where he lives, but he's local. Either college or Nestor Falls. I see him around. Supermarket, hardware store, Walmart, places like that. And once you see him, you don't forget him. His real name is Al. Something Polish. You know, one of those hard-to-pronounce names. Strelkowitz, Stankowitz, something like that. I bet I could find him in the phone book, because he and his brother own a trucking company. Hawkline, I think it's called. Or maybe Eagle Line. Something with a bird in it, anyway. Want me to look him up?
No, thanks, Tess said pleasantly.
You've been helpful enough, and my cab driver's waiting.
Okay. Just do yourself a favor and stay away from that boyfriend of yours. And stay away from the Stagger. Of course, if you tell anyone I said that, I'll have to find you and kill you.
Fair enough, Tess said, smiling. I deserve it.
At the doorway, she turned back.
A favor?
If I can.
If you happen to see Al, something Polish around town, don't mention that you talked to me.
She smiled more widely. It hurt her lips, but she did it.
I want to surprise him, give him a little gift or something.
Not a problem. Tess lingered a bit longer.
I love your eyes.
Neil shrugged and smiled.
Thanks. They don't quite match, do they? It used to make me self-conscious, but now...
Now it works for you, Tess said.
You grew into them.
I guess I did. I even picked up some work modeling in my 20s. But sometimes, you know what? It's better to grow out of things. Like a taste for bad-tempered men. To that, there seemed to be nothing to say. 26. She made sure her expedition would start, then tipped the cab driver 20 instead of 10. He thanked her with feeling, then drove away toward the I-84. Tess followed, but not until she'd plugged Tom back into the cigarette lighter receptacle and powered him up.
"Hello, Tess," Tom said. "I see we're taking a trip."
"Just home, Tommy boy," she said,
and pulled out of the parking lot, very aware she was riding on a tire that had been mounted by the man who had almost killed her. Al, something Polish. A truck-driving son of a gun.
One stop on the way.
"I don't know what you're thinking, Tess, but you should be careful."
If she had been home instead of in her car, Fritzy would have been the one to say this, and Tess would have been equally unsurprised. She had been making up voices and conversations since childhood, although at the age of 8 or 9, she'd quit doing it around other people, unless it was for comic effect.
"I don't know what I'm thinking either," she said,
but this was not quite true. Up ahead was the U.S. 47 intersection, and the gas and dash. She signaled, turned in, and parked with the expedition's nose centered between the two payphones on the side of the building. She saw the number for Royal Limousine on the dusty cinder block between them. The numbers were crooked, straggling, written by a finger that hadn't been able to stay steady. A chill shivered its way up her back, and she wrapped her arms around herself, hugging hard. Then she got out and went to the payphone that still worked. The instruction card had been defaced, maybe by a drunk with a car key, but she could still read the salient information. No charge for 911 calls. Just lift the handset and punch in the numbers. Easy as can be. She punched 9, hesitated, punched 1, then hesitated again. She visualized a piñata and a woman poised to hit it with a stick. Soon everything inside would come tumbling out. Her friends and associates would know she had been raped. Patsy McLean would know the story about stumbling over Fritzy in the dark was a shame-driven lie, and that Tess hadn't trusted her enough to tell the truth. But really, those weren't the main things. She supposed she could stand up to a little public scrutiny, especially if it kept the man Betsy Neal had called Big Driver from raping and killing another woman. Tess realized that she might even be perceived as a heroine, a thing that had been impossible to even consider last night, when urinating hurt enough to make her cry, and her mind kept returning to the image of her stolen panties in the center pocket of the Giant's bib overalls. Only,
"What's in it for me?" she asked again. She spoke very quietly,
while looking at the telephone number she'd written in the dust.
"What's in that for me?"
And thought,
"I have a gun, and I know how to use it."
She hung up the phone and went back to her car. She looked at Tom's screen, which was showing the intersection of Stagg Road and Route 47.
"I need to think about this some more," she said.
"What's to think about?" Tom asked. "If you were to kill him and then get caught, you'd go to jail, raped or not."
"That's what I need to think about," she said,
and turned onto U.S. 47, which would take her to I-84. Traffic on the big highway was Saturday morning light, and being behind the wheel of her expedition was good, soothing, normal. Tom was quiet until she passed the sign reading, "Exit 9, Stoke Village, 2 miles. Then he said, "Are you sure it was an accident?"
"What?"
Tess jumped, startled. She had heard Tom's words coming out of her mouth, spoken in the deeper voice she always used for the make-believe half of her make-believe conversations.
It was a voice very little like Tom the Tom-Tom's actual robo-voice,
but it didn't feel like her thought.
"Are you saying the bastard raped me by accident?"
"No," Tom replied. "I'm saying if it had been up to you, you would have gone back the way you came. This way, I-84. But somebody had a better idea, didn't they? Somebody knew a shortcut."
"Yes," she agreed. "Ramona Norville did."
She considered it, then shook her head.
"That's pretty far-fetched, my friend."
To this, Tom made no reply. 27. Leaving the gas and dash, she had planned to go online and see if she could locate a trucking company, maybe a small independent that operated out of college or one of the surrounding towns. A company with a bird name, probably Hawk or Eagle. It was what the Willow Grove ladies would have done. They loved their computers, and they were always texting each other like teenagers. Other considerations aside, it would be interesting to see if her version of amateur sleuthing worked in real life. Driving up the I-84 exit ramp 1.5 miles from her house, she decided that she would do a little research on Ramona Norville first. Who knew? She might discover that, besides presiding over books and brown baggers, Ramona was present.